Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network.
In the future, none of you are heroes.
You're legends.
Get driven. Stay driven.
Buddy, and welcome to the Bareback Facts. I know it's a little bit early, but let's talk some mythology, huh? Why not? So today we're going to be talking about the Morrigan. For those of you unfamiliar with her, she's particularly popular amongst neo-pagan movements today, and she's got an incredibly rich history, an incredibly rich lineage that she can trace back all the way back to the Copper Age, depending on who you ask. So let's get right into it. Who is or what is the Morrigan? Well, the Morrigan is a goddess, specifically traces herself to the Celts. She goes back to, again, depending on who you ask, depending on what variations of the tales you go back to, she can trace her lineage all the way back to the Copper Age. And she was the dominant goddess of the Celts. She's called the Great Goddess by some. Now, the Morrigan, her name itself is particularly interesting. It's split into two different roots. First is Morrugu, which is, interestingly enough, split again into the word Mor, which means great. Variations of the name include being referred to as Phantom or Spectral, but most scholars today would say that their name means great. It's a great thing about dead languages. A lot of the words mean a lot of different things. And then Gon would be goddess, mother. If we split the other part of her name, Regan, it means queen. So great queen or phantom queen, however you'd like to slice it. Either way, she is associated with a number of interesting things, and she appears prominently in many different Celtic myths, including but not limited to the story of Cú Chulainn and the story of the god Lu. She appears in the Labor Gabala Eren, which is the Book of Invasions, which is dated back to about 1150 CE. And she appears prominently in several legends. She appears in the Tainbo Regenmon, the Ulster Cycle. So she's quite the popular goddess. She is often referred to as a goddess of war, battle, the cycle of life and death, and is associated with wisdom, prophecy, magic, the land, nature, witches, and animals. So she's got quite a lot under her dominion. Most recently, though, she's come to be identified specifically with the concept of sovereignty, as she is a goddess of land and of living things, as well as the goddess of the cycle of life and death. She's been sort of associated with the concept of sovereignty. And when I say sovereignty, I mean lordship over things. So if you really want to dig deep into who she is, it's important to understand the Celtic culture from which she springs from. So early Celts, they idolized warfare. Their people were incredibly warlike. They not only fought against one another, they fought against their neighbors, most of the time over small spits of land throughout what we would now consider to be parts of Western Europe and later Ireland and Britain, the Isles of Britain. And so throughout the history of the Celts, they had been pushed increasingly farther out of Europe by expanding empires such as the Romans, and eventually they're pushed even further by the migrations of other people such as the Saxons, the Angles, the Jutes, and a number of other, you know, warring Germanic tribes in the region. So they spent a lot of their time fighting. And so it comes as no surprise. It should come as no surprise to anybody that because they spent a lot of their time fighting, they kind of grew to sort of accept warfare as a natural part of life. Now, whether or not all Celts just idolized and absolutely worshipped war is a matter of debate. But what we do know is that the Celts were an incredibly militaristic people, whether that was by choice or by necessity, you know, who could really say. But it is well documented that both men and women were warriors up until about 697 CE, often fighting in battle, and the women especially fighting in battle and helping the wounded, protecting their families and their land, which the Celts believed was feminine. The land itself was feminine, and a dominant aspect of the Celts' pride, which was reflected within the Morrigan. Now, the Morrigan first appears again in the Labor Gabala Uren, which is the Book of Invasions, and they date this text to about 1150 CE. It's a pseudo-narrative of the history of Ireland, and it includes the arrival of the Celtic gods, who are known as the Tuatha De Danann in Ireland, and their later battle with the indigenous gods, who some call the Fearblogs, depending on your translations of texts, they are also referred to as the Fomorians. Now, interestingly, these stories were not really written down by the Irish pagans or the Celts because they didn't believe in really writing down their history. They took pride in the oral tradition, in songs and in stories that they passed down from generation to generation. So these stories are later recorded by priests. Christian priests, interestingly enough, which is a little ironic since they were, because once Christianity gets to Ireland and to the Isles of Britain, they kind of try to stamp out most every bit of paganism that they can. So it's interestingly enough a point of irony that they thought these stories were worth preserving. Now, again, the Celts prized oral tradition and memorization. They believed it was an art form of storytelling, and so it was it's kind of a good thing that the Irish Christian monks, who were their descendants, preserved what they believed to be historical accounts. Now, the Morrigan's origins can be traced back quite a long ways. Some people would trace it back to the megalithic cult of the Mothers Matronus e Deces and Decet, who appeared as triple goddesses from narrative texts written by monks sometime between the 8th and 12th centuries after Christianity had replaced many of the pagan faiths as the dominant religion within Ireland. Now, the Morrigan's connection to battle and why the Morrigan is important to the Celts and their culture becomes evident in these texts, although it's not all that she represents. The Morrigan's name in history, as I mentioned, has various spellings and translations, but in Irish her name was originally Mor Rio Gain, meaning Great Queen. Quite an interesting spelling. Her name also was alternatively translated to the Phantom Lady or Phantom Queen. Now, scholars today believe that the most accredited and accurate meaning to the name Morrigan is Great Queen. The meaning connects her to sovereignty, as she was very much revered. She is considered to be one of the more popular deities of the ancient peoples of Europe. Now, it was common within Celtic culture for a goddess to be conveyed in different forms and to possess many attributes to further illustrate her qualities. The Morrigan, also referred to as the Morrugu, was a triad of goddesses sometimes depicted as sisters and at times also depicted as interchangeable. So the Morrigan included three different facets. The first is Babd, the second is Matcha, and the last is Nemon. And occasionally there was another aspect referred to as Anu, who may have been the crone aspect of Babd, but we won't get into that. Now, depending on the text, Babd, Matcha, and Nemon might have been the same entity, but most people just assume that these three are just simply three aspects of the one, which is Morgan. Babd is the war goddess associated with battle, destruction, and death, and often appeared over battle as a hooded crow, or ran alongside warriors disguised as a gray wolf. Now, Babd was connected to rebirth as a watcher of the cauldron of regeneration in the other world, and she was also a witch, a sorceress, and prophetess who foresaw the future. So when Babd appears to heroes within these early Celtic texts and Celtic stories, this is the aspect of the Morrigan that has this otherworldly knowledge. She is the one that people are seeking knowledge from, but also at times staying quite clear of because she's quite terrifying. Then we have Maka. The root for her name is Mog. Translated, this means specifically field, plain, or pasture. The name connects and gives the Morrigan power over the sacred land, over horses, wealth, power, and symbolizing the elite, the most elite among warriors. She was connected to fertility by the land and by horses, and cursed the male red branch warrior to suffer 9 days of birth pangs when forced to run away. As part of the Trinity, she rains down fire and blood on her enemies. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with the Táin Bóg Cúlainn, there is a story. This is a story involving the great epic Irish hero Cúil Cúlainn, who defends Ulster from invasion from the evil Queen Mebd. And Mebd is coming to take the land away from the Ulstermen, who are incapacitated because they managed to somehow insult one of the aspects of the Morrigan, and it was believed that they had insulted Maka. Depending on the translation of the text that you examine, they insulted her, and after challenging her to a contest, they insulted her because they thought she was too feminine to win the contest, and apparently her time came to her, the time of the month that afflicts women came to her in the process of this race. She became a mockery in the race, and as a consequence, the Morrigan cursed the men to suffer 9 days. That they had to suffer, depending on this telling the story, 9 days, and in some cases it was even longer, birth pangs. Basically, they had man periods. As part of the So she cursed them with man periods, and only Cúil Cúlainn, who was under the cutoff age at the time, was immune from this. Unfortunately, for his enemies. Now, the third aspect of the Morrigan is known as the Mann, and her name translates to panic, frenzy, or venom. Or the word venomous. Now, also, this is also a deity of battle, death, and destruction. She appears on the field as a carrion crow. Neeman was a prophetess, and her battle cries meant death would soon follow. By shrieking furiously, she intimidated, panicked, and confused soldiers on the battlefield into dying of fright or mistaking their own comrades for enemies and killing them. This aspect is often connected to the role of another legend, the Banshee. Those of you unfamiliar with Banshee, the Banshee is a spirit that shrieks underneath your window and foretells the coming of a loved one's death. So these are the three aspects of the Morrigan. Now, there are a lot of stories of the Morrigan. They change depending on the source. She's first seen in the Battle of Moytura between a race of gods called the Tuatha De Danann. These are the invading gods, the liberators of Ireland, and their followers, and the indigenous Fir Bolgs, or the Fomorians, led by the demon king Balor of the Evil Eye. Now, before the battle erupts, the Morrigan cries out doom and uses sorcery against the Tuatha De Danann to rain down fire and blood so that they could not move for 3 days and three nights. Thus, she sort of turns the tide of the battle. Then she appears again in the Ulster cycle. She appears in the Táin Bóg Reganma, the cattle raid of Regamon, which is a body of Irish mythology. Morrigan appears to Cúil Cúlainn, whom she has appeared to in several different guises throughout the story, and finds her He finds her stealing one of his cows. She does not yet he does not recognize her and becomes angry, insulting her, shape-shifting into a crow. He then recognizes her and acknowledges he would not have insulted her had he known. Yet she prophesies his death in battle, which later comes to pass. So he insults her. So a little rule of thumb for everybody. If somebody appears to you mysteriously out of nowhere that would not ordinarily pose a threat to you and you insult them and they shapeshift, good rule of thumb is just get the hell out of there because they're probably going to prophesy your death and it's probably going to come true. But if you're lucky, you might not hear that prophecy and it might not happen. So good rule of thumb there. Always avoid insulting old women. You never know what will happen. So Morrigan appears to Cool Kalane as well as a young woman. In some tellings, she appears as a hag. She offers him love and her aid in battle, but he rejects her offer, and in response, she intervenes in his next combat, first in the form of an eel, which trips him, then as a wolf, which stampedes cattle across a ford at him, and finally as a white, red-eared heifer leading the stampede, just as she had warned in their previous encounter. In the Cothmeg Torraid, or Samhain, depending on how you like to spin that word, Morrigan has an encounter with the Dagda, who is the High King of the Tuatha De Nann, before the battle against the Fomorians. When he meets her, she is washing battle clothes while standing with one foot on either side of the River Unius, and they decide to get busy. She then promises to summon the magicians of Ireland to cast spells on behalf of the Tuatha De Nann and to destroy Indek, or Balor, the Fomorian king, depending on which variation of the tale you're reading. For those of you who don't know, Dagda is the sun god in some tellings of the story, but he's also referred to as the king of the Tuatha De Nann. He's sort of a Zeus-like figure. And, of course, he and the Morrigan, therefore, are kind of on even ground at this point. Now, Morrigan is primarily associated with battle, bloodshed, and destruction. She was such a powerful symbol of life and rebirth that the Celts believed she could revive their dead soldiers to fight again. So it was within the rites of many early Celts that there were rites that they practiced in full belief that the Morrigan would raise their dead. The severed heads on the battlefield were called the Mast of Maka, which is a literal translation of the Harvest of Maka. The ground was considered sacred after battle, and soldiers would leave until the next day so that the Morrigan could gather the souls of the undisturbed. As a scavenger bird, she was an omen of war, both as a symbol and with prophecy, feeding on bodies and gathering souls, terrorized armies into dying of fear with her frightful and shrieking cries. Now, the Morrigan is clearly a goddess who embodied a strong woman and the Celtic love of warfare. She used spells and incantations, or magic and sorcery, as her primary weapon. In tales, she is also said to have fought alongside warriors in the battlefield. In earlier Celtic accounts, she sometimes bore a head that was of a crow, a raven, or a vulture, although she is transformed into a white cow with red ears, an eel, an old hag, a young woman. She's also known as Taliek, or crone, and she who grants sovereignty or takes it away from kings. So many Celtic kings often attempted to claim that the Morrigan had chosen them, that that's the reason they were king. This was a way of legitimizing themselves. Early, sort of an ancient version of rule by divine right. Kind of a nifty little thing there. Now, it's speculated that the Morrigan may have been the daughter of another set of gods who appear earlier in the copies of the Labor Gabala Ren, the Book of Invasions. And those gods were Delbath and Aramis. They were said to have had three daughters named Babs, Maka, and Anand. In the Book of Leinster, Anand is also known as Morrigu, while in the Book of Fermoy version, Maka is identified with Morgan. In addition, Morgan may have been one of Dagda's wives and had sons. There's no real evidence of how the Morgan was worshipped in her time, but because she was associated with Samhain, what we would now call Halloween, it is thought that her biggest devotions came during this time. Most of her worship may have been on the battlefields before, during, or after warfare as well, being that she was a goddess of war. We do know very little today about the Celts. We know, because they're not really a culture that wrote a lot, we've only got sort of hand-me-down stories that are later recorded and translated by Christian priests. So we don't quite as much as we would like from them. But we do know that based on Roman accounts of their encounters with the Celts were known to collect the heads of their enemies. They were known to headhunt. They did this. They would often collect heads as trophies. They believed that the head was the seat of a man's power. The head was the place where the soul resided. And so because of this, we do know that those men who were probably worshiping this god, the Morrigan, most likely took these heads not only as trophies, but probably for some other means, perhaps as a tribute to this goddess. Now, there are several sites that are associated with the goddess Morrigan in Northern Ireland, based on some of the texts we have. One place is a county known as Armagh, which translates as Maka's height or Maka's high place. The Dashish na Morrignu, the two breasts of the Morrigan, are a pair of hills in County Arm, which was considered to be the capital on Ulster in the Chronicles, the capital of Ulster in the Chronicles of the Ulster Cycle. In the county of Louth, there is a field known as the Gorch na Morrigan, which is Morrigan's field, which was said to be given to her by the Dagda. Boa Island, which is the largest island in Northern Ireland, it was named after Babd. In addition, inscriptions invoking Cahabduva, the battle raven, may have been found in the Drôme region of France. Now, according to many of the texts that we do have, the Morrigan did possess weapons. She's often seen. She's often described as having spears. She uses sorceries. She carries a shield. She can shapeshift. She has swords. She's associated with death, rebirth, again, the cycle of fate, the cycle of life and death, fate, battle, skulls, blood, prophecies, and sovereignty, as well as land. She has many animal totems that have been associated with her, predominantly scavenger birds such as crows, ravens, vultures. She's also been associated with eels, wolves, cows, horses. She's got many different colors that have been associated with her, red and black, white and purple, dark blue. Lots of good stuff all associated with her. Now, modern-day pagans today, neo-pagans, they have festivals for, depending on what practices they have. Some have the Feast of the Morrigan, which takes place on January 7th. Others worship her around Samhain, which is close to Halloween. She's celebrated during the fall equinox. She's incredibly popular goddess amongst the Celts, has been for many, many, many years. And now she's become refocused, so to speak. She's kind of been revived, reborn under the guise of neo-paganism. Now, neo-pagans believe, and I've talked about this on my show before, I talked about Wicca, and within Wicca there is this belief in the triple goddess and the horned god, who is her consort. Now, the triple goddess is often in reference to a divine feminine, which follows the cycles of the moon. But it's also traced quite closely to the Morrigan, who is a triple goddess who predates, you know, many more modern religions that we have today. And the Morrigan provides a very easy stand-in for the Wicca, for people that practice Wicca. The triple goddess takes on three forms. There is the mother, there is the maiden, and there is the crone. Incidentally, the Morrigan is split into three aspects herself. She appears as a young maiden, appeared as a hag, and she has appeared as a blind old woman. So she's also appeared as, depending on the versions of the story, she is a mother at some points. Excuse me. She's a mother as well, mother to the children of Dagda. The triple goddess within Wicca and within many other neo-pagan religions who believe in the triple goddess represent three phases within life that we all have. Now, I know somebody's going to say, well, I'm not a woman, so how could I be a mother, a maiden, and a crone? Well, there are three aspects within our lives that we all reach. So if you are, when you're a young whippersnapper, you're a maiden, you're innocent, you're pure. You don't know, the deep secrets of the world. That is the aspect of you that is the maiden, that innocence that you have when you're young. In your youthful days, you don't know the dark parts of adulthood. You don't know about, you don't have any real connection to carnal knowledge. You don't have any connection to complex thoughts. You know, you're not corrupted yet by the many philosophies that exist that we later encounter and grapple with throughout our lives. You're not concerned with your mortality. That is the part of your life that in which you are the maiden. You're innocent, you are uncorrupted, you're unsullied, you've not been tainted by the world. Then you reach the point of the mother. Now, the mother represents that change in all of our lives in which we reach a point of intermediate knowledge where we've moved beyond maidenhood. We are now, we're no longer the youngsters that we once were. We're not wide-eyed and innocent. We've been exposed to information that we now have to grapple with. Reality set in. The world is no longer a fantasy. The veil has been lifted, and we can see things for what they are. We have no choice but to now come to grips with the challenges of day-to-day life. So the mother aspect within these neo-pagan religions represents that point in our lives where we've now got to be, where we've finally lifted our veil. We've become more aware of our surroundings. We're ready to grapple with more complex thought. We're ready to take steps within our lives to become wiser, and we're ready to start learning from mistakes. And then the crone. The crone is that final part of our life. And no, I don't mean death. The crone represents that final step in our journey. And whether that's a spiritual journey, whether that's a journey, as far as mature, a physical journey of growth and maturity, whether it's spiritual maturity, maturity within relationships, maturity as far as age, the crone represents that level of maturity that you've reached. You're older now. You're wiser. You've learned from mistakes that you've made. You've been around long enough to make those mistakes. You've learned from them. You're moving forward. You've got experience. And now you've reached the point where you can impart that knowledge onto someone else who's at a different stage in their life than you are. So the Morrigan is also a convenient representation of the very different walks we take in life. When we look at the Morgan, and we even look at this simplified version of the Morgan, this more modernized, more tame version of the Morgan that we have, the triple goddess, we're looking at, you could say you're looking at the phases of the moon, but let's just say we're looking specifically at the representation of the different phases we have in our lives. When we're maidens, again, we're at that point in our lives where we're fresh, we're young, we're eager to receive knowledge, we're eager to seek it. This, when you're a maiden, you're eager to go out and learn, you're eager to go out and experience, you want to taste, you want to see, you want to embrace, you want to breathe everything in, you want to take all of it in. You're living in the moment, you're living in the now, you're not thinking about consequences. Now when you're the mother, it's time to deal with consequences. Now you've reached a point in your life where the choices you made in your maidenhood, in your youth, they're starting to wear and tear on you. Now you've got to recognize that you've made choices in your youth that are now going to affect you in the long run. This is the time in your life in which you've got to rise to the challenge and start moving forward towards becoming a crone. And when you move towards becoming a crone, you're not only going to learn from the mistakes you've made, you're going to make all new mistakes, but you're going to learn from them as you go. And you're going to time to really understand and enjoy life's experiences. So it's not just enjoying the temporary pleasures now. It's understanding and appreciating the journey as you move forward. That's when you've reached the level of mother in your life, that level of within your spiritual life, within your own life, that you have reached the point where now you can learn to appreciate the experience. You can learn to enjoy the ride. When you're young, sure, you're not really thinking about it. You're not really appreciating the things that you have, right? In your youth, you don't really appreciate the fact that you kind of just go run and eat whatever you want and just, you know, live life recklessly, right? You grab life, you grab the bull by the horns, and you've got the world by the haunches, and you can just do whatever you want. Once you start to get older, you realize that you never really had much control over the world around you after all, and it's time to wake up and realize it's time to get a job, time to do big kid things, time to do those adult things that mommy and daddy have been doing the whole time while you were out grabbing the bull by the horns. Now it's time to step forward and become your own person. This is the point in which you have achieved a level of spiritual maturity, a level of mental maturity, in which now you realize, now it's time to pick myself up and become my own person. And then we reach the final stage within life in which you become the crone. And the crone is the person who's lived life's experiences, seen what life's got to offer, and now they're ready. They are ready to show the up-and-coming generations, the maidens and the mothers, what life has to offer, and to guide them on their way. That doesn't necessarily mean that the crone has to steer everyone else's ship. It simply means that the crone is now in a position to see people where they are and help them where they are, because they've experienced what those people have already experienced. Now they're at that position, that level of spiritual or mental maturity in which they now can say, okay, you know, this is what I would suggest you do to let, you know, this is the person you go to for wise counsel. You know, the interesting thing that I find when I look at teas such as the Morgan is how many things that we can use the Morgan as a stand-in for. You know, we
we look at the fact that she's a battle goddess, or you know, been referred to as the Huntress of Souls, or the Mother of Witches, or the Wild Queen, and we think, oh man, those are some cool titles. That's pretty awesome. She's a goddess of warfare. She steals people's souls. That's pretty sweet. But I think it's more interesting that when we consider the fact that the Morrigan can represent these three points within our lives, that chart our progress through life. We have these figures be representative of the many parts of our lives, the steps within life that we take to move forward and to mature. So this is what makes entities, this is what makes stories and mythology such as this so important, is we can learn so much from these things, and we can use them for so many things. But I want to get into another, really interesting aspect of the Morrigan that we kind of skirted over, and I want to go back. Concept of being a huntress of souls. What does that mean exactly? If we look at the many texts involving the Morrigan, when we say that she's the huntress of souls, what does that mean? I mean, we're already looking at a goddess. She's got a great many titles. But the huntress of souls sounds very disturbing when you think about it. But in actuality, this is a title that actually probably filled people with a great deal of comfort. When you consider the fact that we, as people, are often very concerned with our mortality, we're very concerned about what's going to happen when we die, right? Now, you know, there are the nihilists that are going to say, well, you know, who cares what happens when you die? There's many different, you know, people, groups of people out there that are going to say, ah, well, it doesn't really matter what happens if you die, who cares? You'll be dead, whatever. But thousands and thousands of years, they were very concerned about what the heck was going to happen to them when they died. And the Morrigan had answers for the Celts about what would happen when they died. The Morrigan claimed the souls of mighty warriors and took them to the other side. She took them to the realm of the spirits, you know, the land of the fair people, the land of the fair folk. She ensured that they made it on their journey to the land of plenty. Now, the Huntress of Souls only came to take the souls of the fallen, those people who fell gloriously in battle. The Morrigan didn't simply come and take any old soul. She wanted the souls of warriors. She's a warrior goddess. She wanted strong souls. Now, does this make it, you know, this makes it seem like, oh, you know, the Morrigan's only going to help the warriors. But she is that sort of passageway between this life and the next. She is the inevitable. One of the things that is particularly interesting about the Morrigan when she's talked about in this capacity is that the suggestion with her is that she's inevitable. She always wins. Much like death always gets you, she always wins. In every scenario in which people bet with the Morrigan or gamble with the Morrigan, we have Cuchulainn, who denies the Morrigan her, you know, his affections. She demands, you know, she sees Cuchulainn, she wants him. She sees he's handsome and young and virile. And she says, Cuchulainn, you're a sexy guy. I'm a goddess. This is happening. You're gonna love me. You're going to be my new boyfriend. And if you're not, then you're going to die. And I'm going to get you anyway. And Cuchulainn basically spits the offer back in her face and says, that ain't happening. I'm Cuchulainn, baby. I do what I want. Don't you know me? Don't you see what I do? I kill guys all the time. I do whatever I want to do. And if you read the Tame Bull Kullain, which is essentially the epic of Cool Kullain, though it carries, you know, covers a few different heroes here and there. It's spatterings of stories, but predominantly it follows Cool Kullain's life and death. But throughout it, Cool Kullain is basically this Herculean figure. He does what he wants to do, kills whoever he wants to. He doesn't care about the consequences. He's larger than life figure. Pearson says, listen, you're going to do what I say. I want you. You're mine. You're coming with me. You don't come with me, I'm going to get you in the end anyway. Cool Kullain says, that ain't happening, baby. I do what I want. And she basically prophesies his death. She says, well, you're going to die. This is when you're going to die. This is exactly when you're going to die. I know you're going to die. And when you do, I'm going to be there. And that's precisely what happens. He dies. And despite the fact that Cool Kullain, you know, sort of rebelliously dies, he goes out on his feet. He refuses to be cut down, refuses to let the men just, you know, kill him, you know, and beat him to the ground. He doesn't want to be defeated. His pride won't let him fall to the ground. He resolves to die standing on his feet. He ties himself to a large pillar of stone and, you know, kind of swats at these guys until he eventually bleeds to death. But in the end, the Morrigan comes and she takes him. She takes Cool Kullain away and she tells him what I want. I always win. So in this way, the Morrigan represents inevitability. She always wins. Just like death always comes in the end. And while some people might find that disconcerting, I think the early Celts would have found it rather comforting to know that there was going to be certainty. And the certainty was that if they exonerated themselves well in battle and they defended their land with all their heart, mind, and strength, that the Morrigan would come. That she would come. She would take them. Their staunch belief that even she might even have the power to raise their warriors from their graves to fight once more. Their staunch belief in her lay in these stories. These stories of a goddess who had power, who had dominion over land, over the souls of mortals, who had dominion over magics they couldn't possibly fathom or comprehend. We look at the early stories of the Morrigan and her involvement with the Fomorians and her involvement with the Firbolgs and her involvement with the Tuatha De Danann. In the first battle between these gods and basically the equivalent of Irish Titans, the gods lose. And why do they lose? Well, they lose because the Morrigan intervenes. This one entity intervenes in a battle between immortal gods, and the good guys lose because she wills it to be so. She makes it so. She played her game. Didn't matter how, we read these stories of gods such as Lu and Nuada, and they are incredibly powerful warriors. They do what they want to do. I mean, they've got mystical weapons, swords made out of pillars of light that lay waste to mountains. These guys, they're no slouches when it comes to battle. But this one figure, the Morrigan, turns the tide. She rains down holy hell on these guys and ends the battle against them. She decides who wins and who loses. She decides who becomes king and who doesn't become king. She decides who lives and who dies, and she decides when these things happen. So the Morrigan features so prominently in these stories. Who do the Tuatha De Danann come to in the second battle with the Fomorians? They come to the Morrigan. They don't make the same mistake twice. The Morrigan intervened against them. Why in the first battle? Well, if we read the text, we know that the Morrigan intervenes against the Tuatha De Danann initially because they don't come to her. They don't ask for her help. And she feels disrespected. She's this powerful entity. We got it. We can beat these. We can beat these Titan guys that have been ruling everything for since the beginning of time. We got this. We're not going to ask for an ace in the hole. We're just going to take it to these guys. We got this. And she turns the tide of the battle against them because she feels like it, because she feels slighted, because she feels disrespected. They don't make the same mistake twice. They come back the second time around and say, listen, we are not making the same mistake. What can you do for us? What can I do for you? She said, well, I'm going to drive these guys crazy. The Morrigan enters this last battle on the side of the Tuatha De Danann. She drives the Fomorians mad. They attack each other. They kill each other. They retreat. Some of them flee in fear. Some of them lay on each other. Some of them killed themselves, all because of her magic, and they win the day. Now, if you read these stories, it sounds like there's this epic battle between godlike forces. But if you think about it, if you read specifically in the text involving the Morrigan, her impact in both battles decides the outcome. She's the ultimate puppet master in these games for power. She determines the victors, and she determines who's defeated. True aspect of her is this huntress of souls. She determines when souls will be claimed. She determines when you lose your soul. She determines when you fall and where you fall and how you fall. It's all up to her. That's what truly makes the Morrigan a terrifying figure to behold, is that she knows exactly when you're going to die, because she decides when you're going to die. And if there's one thing that we now today would probably find most disturbing, is that we're ever at any point in our lives out of control of our lives. We don't want to live in a world in which we think we're not in control of every aspect of our lives. Now, the rebellious side within human beings that exist, that more than likely existed during this time, I'm sure it did within the human spirit, there is this idea of rebellion, that we must rebel against this, against constructs, against the rules and regulations and things that limit us. We don't want to be limited by any stretch of the imagination. We're always finding things that limit us that we don't want to limit us. And this is a limiter. To be sure, the idea that you don't have control over your own destiny is rather disconcerting. That's probably what makes the Morrigan such an awe-inspiring figure, though, is that she knows the very moment you're going to die, the very moment you're going to fall and be hers, and she's going to be there, ready to claim you. And then we have this aspect of sovereignty. This is one of the things that I think is yet another key facet of hers that's absolutely fascinating. And it's something that's just, you know, more recently been kind of looked at by neo-pagan groups. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this. I'd like to go ahead and mention it. There's actually an order, the Order of Bards, Ovats, and Druids, has an entire collection of literature dedicated to the Morrigan. But I'd also be remiss if I didn't bring up the fact that there is actually a priesthood, a polytheist priesthood of the Morrigan, called the Koro Kathubadua priesthood. They have a website as well, koropriesthood.com. And they dedicate themselves to worshiping the Morrigan. And I'd like to go into some, and before I go into this spiel on sovereignty, I'd like to take a look at some of the things that they believe are core values. This is just to give you guys further insight into just how influential this figure has been. You know, you mentioned the Morrigan now, and people are like, huh, what, who? If you're not a person that's familiar with these mythologies, you're probably just sitting around like, who the hell is this figure? Why is this person even important? Why is this goddess important? So here's the core values of this priesthood. The first is sovereignty and the stone. Now, sovereignty in its historical context, and they rightly define this, is understood as power arising from nature itself, from the identity of the land and its people. Sovereignty is a numinous power within the land, which is vested at the person of the ruler by the source of the power personified as the goddess of sovereignty, according to them. So they believe in the concept of sovereignty, but the way that they believe in it is the concept of personal sovereignty. They state that they hold the value of sovereignty to be paramount as the basis for authentic spiritual practice and right action on an individual level through the practice of personal sovereignty. When we engage the depth of our own true nature and when we stand with the integrity of a true sovereign, we access that numinous power from nature itself and are able to take hold of the authority of our own lives and step into sovereignty. Now, this is a core value I think we all can get behind. You don't have to join the priesthood of the Morrigan. Personal sovereignty and personal responsibility. This statement is really telling. When we engage the depth of our own true nature and when we stand with the integrity of a true sovereign, we access that numinous power from nature itself and we are able to take hold of the authority of our own lives and step into sovereignty. What does that statement mean? It means that when we decide to take responsibility for our lives and move forward with our lives, not only are we going to be able to take personal responsibility for the things that we do and for our own success, but we're taking our destiny into our own hands. We are reaching a point in our lives where we can move forward as individuals and go after the things we really want to. The next value, set of core values that they believe in is the warriorship and the spear. Now, they go into a whole spiel about Lu, the god Lu, and the Tuatha De Nann. Warriorship is, as a spiritual practice, involves fighting for what you believe in and defending those who can't defend themselves. Now, a warrior's primary function is to defend the community against that which strives to abuse and destroy it, with their lives, should that be necessary. Warriorship, however, can also be defined as love in action, fighting for what you value. As all practitioners of the martial and meditative disciplines know, what you practice in the body, you cultivate in the mind. And when you yoga, the mind becomes supple, centered, and energized. When you practice meditation, the mind becomes clear, calm, and attuned. When you practice other things, such as the fighting arts, the mind becomes resilient, resolute, and indefatigable, alive with survival instinct. It's practice that creates strength and kinship, survival skill, and the ability to defend what we love. So this, when we talk about warriorship in this concept, this value of warriorship, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to be violent. You could simply stand up for yourself, stand up for the things that you believe in or are passionate about. These are great things to value. Of course, they talk about service to the community, service in the sword. They talk about the power of service teaches us that true sovereignty is a path of personal sacrifices. We must act from a commitment to the well-being and protection of that which is in our care above and serve for ourselves. Then hospitality. And this is something that's kind of an old tradition, but one that we kind of don't think about anymore. We affirm our kinship with all peoples regardless of race or ethnicity and our responsibility to act in respect of that kinship in a way that expresses care and honor toward our fellow beings. And we affirm the connectedness of the living with both the ancestors in whose steps we follow and the descendants who will come after us and inherit the world we make for them. This is the value I want to talk about. This priesthood having that I find particularly intriguing.
it's interesting that we see these revivals of some of these old gods and goddesses today within these neo-pagan organizations. And so many people are quick to say, oh my gosh, they're going to be demon worshippers. Oh my gosh. Think about the children. But when you listen to some of these core values, this concept of hospitality as these people are defining it, that's a little bit different than the old and the medieval way of defining hospitality. But nonetheless, this is more or less defined as courtesy and the like. But this idea that affirming your kinship with all peoples, regardless of race, ethnicity, and our responsibility to act in respect to that kinship in a way that expresses care and honor toward all our fellow beings. Affirming the goodness of the living with both ancestors in whose steps we follow, and the descendants, those who come after us and inherit the world we make for them. What kind of world do we want to make for those people who come after us? That's the real question that the Morrigan can force us to ask ourselves. I talked about how the Morrigan can be representative of these different steps within life that we take. We're all at different markers in our journey. We're all at different points in life. Nobody is at the same exact point in life as everybody else. We're all on our own journey, and we're all getting there on our own time. But we've all got to reach this realization that we are all people and we're all on a journey. And even though we're all works in progress, it doesn't mean that we're any less important than anybody else. And it also doesn't mean we're any more important than anybody else. We got to find our own balance. That's the real lessons we can learn from the Morrigan. Now, I want to get into this concept of sovereignty before I conclude today talking about the Morrigan. It's been a very enriching conversation, very refreshing to talk about some stuff like this, very exciting stuff, I think. I think it's fun. But I talked about the concept of sovereignty. Sovereignty, just because you have power over something, it's important to remember that having power over something, it goes back to the old Spider-Man quote, with great power comes great responsibility. When you have power over something, you are responsible for that something. And the Morrigan has been attributed with having power over the land, having dominion over souls. So she's responsible for these things as well. When we think about these core values, that I mentioned that are being brought up by this priesthood that's dedicated themselves to the worship of the Morrigan today. We all have sovereignty over ourselves, stability for ourselves, and we've got to understand that we have a responsibility not only for ourselves, but to ourselves, to be better versions of ourselves. Now let that sink in for a minute. You know, too often we see people we know, and even we ourselves do this. I know I've done it. I can't speak for everybody out there, but I'm almost certain somebody else could relate to this. I think we've all reached points in our lives where we've said, it's somebody else's fault, right? I'm in this position, and it's this person's fault. But is it really that person's fault, or are you just unwilling to take responsibility for your part in all of it? Every single one of us has choices that we can make. We've all got this wonderful thing called a brain, and we use that brain to make choices. We use that brain to enact our will upon the world around us. And when we do these things, when we enact our will upon the world around us and we make choices, we're responsible for those choices. We're responsible for our will
what we sow into the world, we're responsible for. Whether it's children, whether it's ideas, literature, whatever. Whatever it is that you bring to the table, you're responsible for it. You have to, and that includes your gifts as well. Whatever you're good at, you're responsible for what you're good at. Nobody, you have sovereignty over what you're good at. Nobody can take that away from you unless you let them take it away from you. Nobody can take away your ability to do what you want to do unless you give that away. Now, people would say, well, what if I go to jail? What if I get captured by somebody or kidnapped? Would you make every choice you make has a reaction. Just like every action has an equal and opposite reaction, you have an impact on the world around you, and the choices you make put you in the situations that affect your day-to-day life. You are in control of your life, and you're responsible for your life. And you can't act like you're not in control of your life and responsible for your life. Because when you do, you're denying your own sovereignty. And that's giving away your freedom. That's giving away your sovereignty. That's giving away your power. No one can take away your personal power unless you give it away. You have all the potential in the world to do anything you want to do. You've got all the personal power you could possibly want. But if you abuse it, if you give it away, if you make bonehead decisions, you're throwing it away. Can learn from the Morgan is that the Morgan never threw away her sovereignty. In every story involving the Morgan, she comes out on top, and she comes out on top because she doesn't let people take away her thunder. She doesn't let people take away her sovereignty. She determines the time and the place when things are going to happen. She determines destiny. She makes destiny. She forges fate for herself. And she forges the fate of heroes. Now, I'm not saying that you yourself can forge the fate of heroes, but you can make your own destiny. Forge your own destiny. And you can make it as glorious and wonderful and beautiful as you want it to be. Or you can make it as terrible and miserable and boring and bland and awful as you let it be. But in the end, the one thing that you have to remember is you have sovereignty over your life. You have a responsibility for your life because you have that sovereignty in your own life. I hope you guys have enjoyed today's show. I hope you learned a lot about the Morgan, and I hope you enjoyed it. I'm going to give you guys some text that you can look at, examine if you wish to do so. I'm going to recommend, again, the Tane Bolkuane. It's a great epic. Those of you out there, if you've seen the movie Troy, if you've seen Clash of the Titans or Wrath of the Titans, whatever, Immortals, the like. The Tane Bolkuane reads a lot like the Iliad. It's pretty good read. It's a good story. You get epic heroes, gods and goddesses going at it. It's all that you can want. You can also take a look at The Guide to the Ancient Gods and Legends by Miranda Aldhouse Green. Myth, Legend, and Romance, an Encyclopedia of Irish Folk Tradition. You can look at John T. Koch's Celtic Culture, a Historical Encyclopedia.
I, of course, would recommend you also take a look at The Guises of the Morrigan, Irish Goddess of Sex and Battle, Her Myths, Powers, and Mysteries by David and D'Esta Rankin. You can take a look at Feast of the Morrigan, A Grimoire for the Dark Lady of the Emerald Isle by Christopher Penzack, and Patricia Monaghan's Encyclopedia of Goddesses and Heroines. It's a pretty good read. I would also recommend, ready to go, Tara Reynolds, The Morrigan, Goddess Connections Workbook, and finally, The Irish Invasion Myths, Myths and Legends of the Celtic Race, by T. Rolleston. Good. All good, good places to start, especially if you're just looking for source material on the Morrigan, or if you're just looking to get into some more mythology. If you like mythology, you know, there's just a plethora of good stuff out there to read that will, I mean, people underestimate mythology, but these are the big stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, and we can learn so much from those people who came before us. What they thought was important, we might still find some value in. There's something valuable in it. So that's all I've got for you guys today. Hope you enjoyed the show. I'll be back next week with another interesting figure from mythology. This one hails from Haiti, though. Very, very interesting guy. Goes by the name of Baron Samedi. And Baron Samedi is a death god in his own right, but he likes to party. He's a party animal. Very interesting character. We're going to talk a lot about that. We're going to talk about him in the context of, you know, those who worship him, you know, the myths and stories associated with him. He's a very interesting figure. You know, I honestly find the I think you guys will agree with me when you learn a little bit about Baron Samedi. Those of you unfamiliar with him, that he's a card. He's a really fascinating guy. He's kind of funny, but he's also a grim kind of character. He's still got a lighter spin on death. Not as heavy as the Morrigan. You know, he's a guy that likes to party. So come back. See you guys next Wednesday morning. We're going to talk about Baron Samedi because death likes to party too, guys. Thanks for listening today. Hope you enjoyed the show. And, of course, you can catch me live as well on Sunday morning with Straight Football Talk. And this week we've got Juwan Lewis coming to the show. Very excited. We're booked all the way into November with interviews for Straight Football Talk. And, guys, football's back. Very exciting stuff. So hope you'll catch me there with Teddy the Bear Tate live Sunday morning from 9 a.m. Eastern Time to 12 p.m. Eastern Time. Until then, enjoy the rest of your week, guys, and we'll talk soon.